This lesson was taught on October 10, 1999 at the Reformed Baptist Church of Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Now this is our fifth lesson and last on our survey of the discussion of eschatology, or the doctrine of last things, that's been taking place in the Christian church for 20 centuries. Now, I wish it hadn't been five whole lessons, honestly, but then if you think that I've covered 20 centuries in 5 hours, that's pretty good, isn't it? But at any rate, I hope you'll find that as we conclude this study today of the history of the church, and its discussion of the doctrine of last things, that we'll have acquainted you with the terminology of Christian eschatology, the questions related to it, and the options before you as we turn to the study of the Word of God next week. Now, let me review where we've been. We began with the great conversation in the early church. I looked at the earliest Christians that we have any record of, the Apostolic Fathers. Saw that the great debate there was with regard to whether they were all premillennial. And having looked at the evidence, we saw that Dr. Feinberg's assertion that the early church was premillennial almost to a man was both overstated and wishful in its character. And then we looked at the growth of early premillennialism, because after the earliest church it did grow. Men like Justin Martyr held it, although in a somewhat inconsistent form, in a form not normally taught today. Irenaeus, Tertullian, and the Montanists also held it. And that was fateful, because the Montanists were condemned in early synods, and along with their condemnation, premillennialism fell into disrepute. There were other premillennialists. We looked at our conclusions. What about the doctrinal significance of this early premillennialism? Does this evidence that many early Christians, although not all, were premillennial, does it mean that it originated with apostolic Christianity? We said, no, not necessarily. It's possible that premillennialism originated with ancient Judaism. Both are possibilities that cannot be discounted simply on the basis of what we've looked at. Then we saw the withering of early premillennialism had two causes: the excesses of Montanism. Their excesses brought it into disrepute. And then the verdict of Augustine was authoritative for a whole medieval church for 1,000 years. Premillennialism was not taught widely in the church at all. So we saw the growth and withering of premillennialism from the time of Papias till Augustine repudiated it in the year 400 approximately, in his great treatise on the City of God. And then we came to look at, if I can get my right lesson here, we will. We looked at the second part of this great conversation. I'm sorry, I don't have that overhead immediately at hand, so I'm not going to bother you with it. And which we saw that the Reformation Church basically adopted the old amillennialism of Augustine. With one little wrinkle, they identified the great beast of the book of Revelation as the papacy, and taught that the papacy was the Antichrist. This was certainly the position of both Luther and Calvin. They also taught an historicist view of the book of Revelation, which saw it as a consecutive symbolic chronology of the Christian church. And then we began to look at the rise of three different eschatologies that have played a part in the church since the time of the Reformation. After the Reformation, through a process of events, post-millennialism, the idea that there will be a great millennial period before Christ comes back, arose among the Puritans and in the British part of Christianity. Then there was a reaction against that that we looked at last week, as we looked at the reaction of premillennialism to that. We saw the identity of early premillennialism. It was its general character. as a reaction against postmillennialism, but also embracing this historicism in the book of Revelation. A specific appeal consisted in a new passion for the interpretation of prophecy, a renewed interest in the condition of the Jews, and a revived faith in the imminent return of Christ. We saw the fall of historicist premillennialism with all the predictions of Christ's return that they got engaged in failing. It fell into disrepute both in Britain and America. And this gave rise to what we call futurist premillennialism, which is the interpretation of the book of Revelation that sees in it not a consecutive chronology in symbolic form of the whole present age, but relegates it all to a future tribulation at the end of the age, from chapter 4, chapter 6, all the way through chapter 19. And so this futurist premillennialism wasn't in danger of trying to predict the time of Christ's return on the basis of the symbols found in the book of Revelation. We saw its genesis in Edward Irving and J.N. Darby. We saw the importance of futurist premillennialism because it gave birth to what is known commonly and widely today as dispensational premillennialism. And we saw that dispensational premillennialism became dominant among most premillennialists and premillennialists in America particularly. Now today, we come, having looked at the rise of postmillennialism and the reaction of premillennialism, to look at the return of amillennialism. There's a couple of things to say by way of introduction. First thing that I want to say by way of introduction to this part of our study is that I want to talk about the major adversaries or opponents in the 20th century, our century, although it's about to end. And those two adversaries were no longer postmillennialism and premillennialism per se, but amillennialism versus dispensationalism. Now, if I had the time and if it were an interest to you, I think I could prove to you that really historical premillennialism and postmillennialism didn't play a very big part in the debate about eschatology in the 20th century. In fact, one man says, and he was a man who's one of the premier systematic theologians of our century, his name is John Murray, he says, in the judgment of the present writer, and he wrote this in 1942, it's regrettable that in current literature on the millennial debate, so little attention is paid to the postmillennial position. It's neglected, he says. Just as a great amount of the debate in the century that has passed suffered from neglect of the amillennial position, and consequently much of the premillennial criticism rested upon an ignorance or an ignoring of the amillennial view, so now the debate is impoverished and in some cases prejudiced by ignoring the postmillennial view fairly or completely. So Murray is saying that postmillennialism was fairly well ignored in the early parts of our century. Now, there's a second thing I want you to notice that took place in the 20th century. And that is, there was a kind of doctrinal advance. And let me tell you what that advance consisted in. It became fairly widely known that there were really four kinds of four interpretation of Christian eschatology or Christian prophecy that were held by Bible-believing Christians. And this became fairly well organized, and even books were published delineating the differences between these four different views. Those four different views were dispensational premillennialism, historic or covenant premillennialism, amillennialism, and postmillennialism. And for the first time in the 20th century, it became fairly clear there are four different kinds of views held among Christians. And I want to show you those four views and just talk through the differences between them briefly with you this morning, because I think it will be helpful to summarize that here. In eschatology, there are four major Christian views. We begin with, and I don't know what you want to call it, left or right, okay? But there's a spectrum here from left to right. So I'll I'll show my prejudices and put dispensational premillennialism on the left. Okay? But at any rate, in dispensational premillennialism, you have the law given to Israel. You have that succeeded by the dispensation which is called the Age of Grace or the Church Age. The church is viewed as a mystery people of God. Then you have the secret rapture before the tribulation, the second advent of Christ after the tribulation, or the revelation of Christ, because really both the secret rapture and revelation are part of the second advent of Christ for a dispensationalist. And then after the tribulation, you have the millennium. And at the period of the secret rapture of the church out of the world, God begins to deal with Israel again. That's dispensational premillennialism. Historic premillennialism, so-called, because it was the kind of premillennialism held by the early church fathers, says that there was this kind of progression. You had Old Covenant Israel. Then at the cross and resurrection of Christ, you had the advent of the Gospel Age. The church is viewed as the new Israel of God. It's not distinct from Israel. It is the new Israel. Then you have the second advent of Christ and the millennium. And there the church is the new Israel of God as well. Now in amillennialism, you have, again, the Old Covenant, the cross and resurrection of Christ, the Gospel Age, which is viewed as equivalent to the 1,000 years of Revelation 20. Christ is reigning in heaven. You have the second coming of Christ. And then no millennium after Christ comes back. You have the eternal state. In postmillennialism, you have basically the same structure as amillennialism, except the period of time between the cross and resurrection of Christ and the second coming of Christ is really divided into two parts. You have the humiliation of the church or its persecution in the first part of this period of time, and we look forward to the millennium, which is going to take place prior to the second coming of Christ, and hence Christ's coming as post-millennial. And during that millennium, before Christ comes back, there's going to be the exaltation of the church and the great golden age of righteousness, peace, and prosperity in the world. And the second coming of Christ succeeds that, and then you have the eternal state. All right? Now, I've shown most of that before, in fact, all of that before, but I want to systematically show it to you in one place. But now, I thought what might also be helpful to you is if I compared the different systems in different ways. So let me do that. Different classifications of the major views. Now, you can classify these views by the relation of the return of Christ to the millennium. What do these views say about the relation of the return of Christ to the millennium? Is it before or after the millennium? Well, there are two views that are premillennial, and in a sense, two views that are postmillennial in their view of the return of Christ. The premillennial views are dispensationalism and historic premillennialism. The postmillennial views are amillennialism and postmillennialism. So in a sense, amillennialism is a form of postmillennialism, right? Because amillennialism says that Christ's return comes after the millennium, so his coming is postmillennial. So, even though technically we make a distinction between amillennialism and postmillennialism, yet they're in one sense both postmillennial. Does that make sense? Okay, you can see that. If you have questions about that, feel free to ask it towards the end of class. Now, you can also relate these different classifications of the major views by the relation of the return of Christ to a future tribulation. Now, that is to say, you can classify them in terms of whether they think the return of Christ is before or after a future tribulation. And in this classification, there are pre-tribulational and post-tribulational views. The one pre-tribulational view is dispensationalism. The post-tribulational views are historic premillennialism, amillennialism, and depending what kind of postmillennialist you are and if you have a tribulation or not as a postmillennialist, a postmillennialism could also be ranked as post-tribulational. Certainly they don't believe in a pre-tribulational coming of Christ. The only question is whether they have a tribulation at all. Okay? So we can divide these views up in terms of whether they're pre-tribulational or post-tribulational views of the return of Christ. And a couple of other ways that you can look at these views. You can look at them in accordance with their view of the relationship of the church and Israel. What do they say about the relationship of the church and Israel? Well, dispensationalism says that the church is distinct from Israel, but it differs from the other forms of Christian eschatology in that place because the church is the new Israel for historic premillennialism, amillennialism, and postmillennialism. And there should be no parenthesis and no question mark, because that ought to be the case with, and is the case with, postmillennialism there. That's a problem in the overhead, okay? All right? So, with regard to the relationship of the church in Israel, dispensationalism is by itself as over against the other three historic views of the church. Now, you can also divide up these views in a fourth and last way. You can categorize them by whether they believe in a future millennium before the eternal state. Now, I think I've told you about this word, but there's another word for millennialism or millenarianism, a word based upon the Latin. It's an English word. It's the word chiliasm. It comes from that Latin word for thousand. And so chiliasm is millenarianism or millennialism. Now, there are three views that are chiliastic, then, and that they believe in a future millennium. And there's one view that's not. The chiliastic views are dispensationalism, historic premillennialism, and postmillennialism. They all believe in a future millennium. Amillennialism does not believe in a future millennium. It believes that the 1,000 years of Revelation 20 are right now, and they don't refer to a great golden age of righteousness, peace, and prosperity on earth, and therefore it's called amillennial. Now, I should say something right here. Some amillennialists have kind of been uncomfortable with this this terminology, because it seemed to imply that they didn't believe in the 1,000 years of Revelation 20 at all. Well, that's not true, of course. So they have wanted to say that they were realized millennialists or something like that, because they believe that the 1,000 years is already taking place. All right? So there are four ways that you can classify these different views: by their belief in the future millennium, by the relationship that they teach with regard to the church in Israel, by a relation of the return of Christ to the millennium of Revelation 20, and by the relation of the return of Christ to a future tribulation. Now, that was what I was saying, just by way of introduction to what I've called the return of amillennialism or synthesis. All right? Now, I want to, in the first place this morning, then, as we come to deal with the return of amillennialism, deal with its setting, the setting of this return. Okay? And the first thing that characterizes this setting was a century of debate between premillennialism and postmillennialism. I've already told you the story of how postmillennialism became the dominant eschatological system of evangelicals during the 17th and 18th centuries. And thus, that whole great Donnybrook of an eschatological fight in the 17th and 18th centuries was not between amillennialism and premillennialism, but between premillennialism reacting against postmillennialism. And it's interesting that you realize then that if that was the debate, where is it? Right here. The debate of the 17th and 18th centuries was a debate about between two groups of Christians both of whom were teleostic, because the debate was really between premillennialism and postmillennialism. So all believed in that debate in the 17th and 18th centuries. All of them assumed that there was a future millennium. The only question was whether it was a premillennial kind of millennium or a postmillennial kind of millennium. All right? Make sense? And that's very important to understand, that that's who the debate was between. Between premillennialists and postmillennialists, both shared a common faith in the future millennium, a golden age before the eternal state was ushered in. Now, the second thing, that characterized this setting was the triumph of premillennialism among Bible believers. The triumph of premillennialism. In this fight between premillennialism and postmillennialism, premillennialism won. Period. All right? Not as though postmillennialism was wiped out, but it really was overrun by premillennialism. Now the question is, why did premillennialism win? Now, of course, I'm not going into the fact that premillennialists would say, well, it won because it was more biblical. Well, all right, that's what you think, and that's fine. Then you have to explain why amillennialism won in the early church. Was that because it was more biblical? Well, the point I'm going to make here is that whether or not, whatever you think about the biblical debate, there are three reasons why premillennialism really won the day among evangelicals. And I want to talk about those three reasons with you right now. The first one was postmillennialism's association with rationalism. During the 19th century, one of the things that was happening in the Christian church was the onset of the heresy that we know as modernism or liberalism. Right? Now, at the same time, this heresy of modernism and liberalism was buying into the spirit of the age. And one of the spirit of the age then, in the 19th century especially, was what theory that came to the fore in the scientific realm? Joseph? Evolution. Evolution taught that basically the world was evolving from a more primitive into a more advanced state. Now, you can see that if people were trying to accommodate themselves to the spirit of the age and still maintain some name and grasp on their Christianity, that the theory of Christian eschatology that would be most appealing to them would be the one that would seem most in accord with the spirit of the age. The spirit of the age was one in which everybody was so excited about scientific advancement, and there was this theory of evolution that everything was getting better and better, and this kind of got mixed up with postmillennialism. You follow why that would happen? All right? Postmillennialism was optimistic, and so were they. They were both optimistic about the future of the world. And so the old postmillennialism of the Puritans and Jonathan Edwards that looked to the preaching of the gospel as the way in which the millennium was going to come began to be kind of watered down and melted into this new view, this optimistic kind of rationalism with evolution and with liberalism, and it just kind of all got melted together. And the problem was that then, therefore, with regard to evangelical Bible believers, postmillennialism became associated with modernism and liberalism in their mind. You understand? And of course, therefore, it had a strike against it, or two strikes against it already. So while the older postmillennialism had been a kind of Bible postmillennialism, now it begins to melt into and become associated with this kind of optimistic rationalism of liberalism and evolution. The second thing that happened is that you had premillennialism's emphasis on the biblical hope. There was a biblical emphasis in premillennialism that couldn't be denied and that looked really much more biblical, especially as compared to the kind of watered-down postmillennialism of the semi-liberals. And this was that emphasis of premillennialism on the biblical hope of the believer. What is the biblical hope of the believer? We look for the blessed hope and the glorious appearing of our great God and Savior, Jesus Christ. The biblical hope is the return of Christ and the resurrection of the saints. And when premillennials began to preach that with a vengeance, it certainly sounded a whole lot more biblical than what they were hearing from their watered-down postmillennial preachers. Right? It was more biblical. So the second reason for the triumph of premillennialism was that the postmillennialism, even of conservatives during the centuries of its dominance, had more and more focused the hopes and expectations of Christians not on the return of Christ, not on a glorious resurrection of the dead, but upon this future millennium to be brought in by the preaching of the gospel. And wonderful as that might have been, it simply wasn't the biblical hope. The biblical hope now was being preached by premillennialists who preached the return of Christ, the imminent return of Christ, and the resurrection of the dead. And when evangelicals looked at their Bibles, they said, this is what the Bible teaches. Right? And so, when premillennialism arose, sounding the clarion trumpet of the second advent of Christ and the resurrection of the believer, and when it pointed to the clear New Testament witness that his coming was the believer's hope and his coming was near, this proclamation came with a kind of thrilling power and extraordinary freshness to Bible-believing Christians whose future perspectives have been dominated by the postmillennialism of the age. Well, there was a third reason that postmillennialism went into decline, and that was, I think, nothing more extraordinary than about 50 years of everything in the world contradicting this positive, optimistic outlook. What happened in the first half of the 20th century? You had this wonderful optimism of the 19th century. Everything's getting better and better. We have all these scientific advancements. We're going to conquer all our problems. And what happened? You had the Great War. You had the First World War. And millions upon millions of the youth of the most advanced nations in the world being battered to death in the trenches of Western Europe with no result for years and years and years. And what was that followed by? The Great Depression. And then what was that followed by? It was followed by the Second World War, which was preceded by the rise of communism and Stalinism in the Soviet Union and Nazism in Hitler's Germany, and the rise of these awful, you couldn't even choose between them, they were both so awful, awful dictatorships dominating two of the most powerful nations in the world. And with that came the Second World War. And the Second World War followed and ended by the coming of nuclear energy and nuclear weapons, and then the specter of the Cold War for 30 years. This didn't seem like the future postmillennialists were looking for. Well, you say, that's not fair. It's not fair. Because we shouldn't judge biblical eschatology from world events. That's true. That's true. But you see, postmillennialism wasn't the first eschatology to benefit from world events or to be destroyed by world events, was it? You had the rise of historicist premillennialism because of the French Revolution's ejecting the Pope from Rome, and everybody thought that was the end of the 1260 years and the deadly wound of the beast, right? And it just so happens that dispensational premillennialism looked really prophetic when they created the State of Israel in 1948. And Christ had to come back in the next generation. The only problem is it's been 51 years since then. Well, you see, the point is, we may not think it's right, and postmillennialists may not think it's right, that that it's form of eschatology to be judged on the basis of world events, and they're probably right, but the fact is this is no doubt one of the major reasons why it fell into that text decline, whether it was right or not. Because right now we're not talking about what's right. We haven't got to the Bible yet. We're just talking about what happened and why it happened. This is probably why it happened. All right? Now, there was another thing in this setting of the return of amillennialism that was important. And this was the destruction of an alliance between premillennialists and conservatives in fundamentalism. You know that in response to liberalism, there was the publication of this long series of books called The Fundamentals, in which all conservative Christians, many conservative Christians from different backgrounds, gave a united front to defend the fundamentals of the Christian faith against liberalism and modernism. Well, in those books, The Fundamentals, there was a kind of alliance that took place between people that really didn't have much in common except that they were Bible-believing Christians. And one of the ways you can epitomize this alliance was in what happened with the rise of Westminster Seminary in Philadelphia. Let me tell you about Westminster Seminary. Westminster Seminary was the reaction against the liberalism in the Presbyterian bodies, especially the Northern Presbyterians in the United States. J. Gresham Machen was actually disciplined out of the Northern Presbyterian Church. Great man that he was, they finally found an occasion to boot him out. And Machen, along with two other men, one of which at least I think whose name you will know, began Westminster Theological Seminary in what was called the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. But the only problem was that after they'd started Westminster Seminary and the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, there began to surface some underlying and fairly basic disagreements between these different men. There was J. Gresham Machen, who with the able assistance of John Murray, basically represented the historic Reformed tradition. But then there was Carl McIntyre. Ever heard of him? He was the anti-communist Bible Presbyterian preacher, and he was a dispensationalist. And along with Machen and McIntyre, there was a man by the name of Alan McRae. And all of them had allied themselves together in this new Orthodox Presbyterian body. I'm sorry, it was not called the Orthodox Presbyterian Church at that time. It was called the Presbyterian Church of America. All right. Now, what happened was, over the issue, well, I'll just tell you what the issues were. There were two issues over which the Presbyterian Church of America, this conservative body that had just been started to oppose the liberalism of the Northern Presbyterians, there were two issues over which it finally broke up. Abstinence, that is to say, abstinence from all forms of alcoholic beverages, and premillennialism. J. Gresham Machen, representing the historic Reform body, said you can't find abstinence or premillennialism in the Bible. This caused a disagreement between himself and the dispensationalist Carl McIntyre and the premillennialist Alan McRae, and they went their separate ways. Alan McRae started the Reformed Presbyterian Church Evangelical Synod. Probably the most famous member of that church was Francis Schaeffer. Carl McIntyre started the Bible Presbyterian Church, and of course was known for his anti-communist crusades in the following decade. And the Orthodox Presbyterian Church was begun, and Westminster Seminary, dominated by J. Gresham Machen, John Murray, R.B. Kuyper, Cornelius Van Til, and a number of other Reformed luminaries, as they're called. Well, this was the destruction of this, and this alliance against liberalism broke up, and this is kind of seen in a microcosm in a small way in what happened to this Presbyterian church of America. All right, that's the setting of the return of amillennialism. A century of debate between premillennialism and postmillennialism, the triumph of premillennialism among Bible believers for several reasons, and the destruction of the alliance between premillennialists and conservatives in fundamentalism. And now I want you to look at the sources of this return. Where did amillennialism return from? Well, basically it returned out of the Purified Reformed Witness of Westminster Seminary and others from a conservative Dutch Reformed background, and they mounted a major assault against the fortress of dispensationalism. Now, there were other attacks that came from the remaining postmillennial people who began to call both the dispensationalists and the amillennialists pessimillennialists. But it's a simple matter of historical accuracy to say that the major resistance to dispensational dominance in the 20th century has come from amillennialism. And then, let's see, is that where I wanted to show you this one? No, not yet. I want to talk about the synthesis. What happened? What kind of amillennialism was it that returned? Well, first of all, I want to just say something by way of explanation. The amillennialism which returned to assault dispensationalism in the 20th century was one matured and made wiser through its observation of the conflict between premillennialism and postmillennialism. Because, first of all, it was an amillennialism which through its understanding of the vulnerability of postmillennialism to the emphasis of premillennialism on the imminence of Christ's return, had learned that the true hope of the believer was Christ's return and the resurrection of the dead. And so it emphasized, amillennialism did, the imminence of Christ's return. The second thing that was characteristic of this returning amillennialism was that it was an amillennialism which wished to distance itself from the charge of spiritualizing that had all so often been made against it. Premillennialists had said that the postmillennialists and amillennialists were spiritualizing and allegorizing. Sometimes this had come too close to the truth with regard to the older Augustinian amillennialism. So they wanted to distance themselves from the charge of spiritualizing. The third thing they wanted, and they did, was that this was an amillennialism which was aware of the biblical emphasis on an earthly reign of Christ, and which now laid emphasis upon the doctrine of a redeemed earth. So what basically had happened was that amillennialism itself had changed. Amillennialism itself had matured. And what it did was take seriously the emphasis on the imminent return of Christ, and saw that that emphasis was a biblical emphasis, as opposed, and agreed with premillennialism there. And what also it had done, it had incorporated into itself the idea that the Bible did point forward to a time of earthly glory for the church. And these are both had been emphases that have been associated in everybody's mind at that point. Now, too often in the past, amillennialists had interpreted the promises of the Bible with regard to this, what looked like prophecies of earthly glory. They had interpreted them as a reference to heaven or to the present spiritual glory of the church. And amillennialists today have become increasingly aware that in order really to meet and understand those prophecies, you have to see that there is a biblical emphasis upon an earthly reign of Christ, and they emphasize the doctrine of a redeemed earth. Now, be patient, because I'm going to show you a couple of charts to explain what I'm saying in a second. But I need to quote here two really important paragraphs from Anthony Hookeman's book entitled The Bible in the Future. He's part of this returning amillennialism, and I think he understands some things of great importance, so let me quote him. Dispensationalists, says Hookema, accuse us amillennarians of spiritualizing prophecies of this sort so as to miss their real meaning. John F. Walvoord, for example, says, The many promises made to Israel are given one of two treatments by amillennialists. By the traditional Augustinian amillennialism, these promises are transferred by spiritualized interpretation to the church. See the charge of spiritualizing. The church today, as the true Israel, inherits the promises which Israel lost in rejecting Christ. The other more modern type of amillennialism holds that the promises of righteousness, peace, and security are poetic pictures of heaven and fulfilled in heaven, not on earth. On a later page, after quoting and referring to a number of prophetic passages about the future of the earth, Walberg goes on to say, "By no theological alchemy should these and countless other references to earth as the sphere of Christ's millennial reign be spiritualized to become the equivalent of heaven, the eternal state, or the church, as amillenarians have done." And then Hookema says this, "To the above we may reply that prophecies of this sort should not be interpreted as referring either to the church of the present time or to heaven, if by heaven is meant a realm somewhere off in space far away from earth. Prophecies of this nature should be understood as descriptions in figurative language to be sure of the new earth which God will bring into existence after Christ comes again, a new earth which will last not just for 1,000 years, but forever." Now, let me show you a chart which I hope will make all of this plain to you. What we're talking about here is amillennial interpretations of the millennial prophecies of the Old Testament. How did the older amillennialism deal with those prophecies? Well, there was a spiritualizing tendency, and they saw these Old Testament prophecies as pointing forward either to a glorious heaven or a glorious church of the present age. Well, there's a newer amillennialism that has a more literalistic tendency, and it sees Old Testament prophecy as pointing forward to not just the church, but to a glorious new earth. And so amillennialism has matured and in some respects changed somewhat as it's observed this debate, century of debate, between premillennialism and postmillennialism. All right? However, it wasn't just amillennialism that changed. As a result of this onslaught, dispensationalism began to change. Whether through its assault, through the assault of its enemies, perhaps also from its own inherent instability, the classical dispensationalism of Darby in the Schofield Reference Bible has shown a clear tendency to splinter and to be modified in recent years. Some books that you might be interested in this regard. Grover Gunn and Curtis Crenshaw in their book entitled Dispensationalism, Today, Yesterday, and Tomorrow distinguish classical dispensationalism and neo-dispensationalism. Mark Sarver in his notes on this subject distinguishes four types of dispensationalism that now exist: Bullingerite hyper-dispensationalism, hardline or classical dispensationalism, neo-dispensationalism, and those whom Sarver calls the one people of God dispensationalists. And then there's an anthology entitled Continuity and Discontinuity, Perspectives on the Relationship Between the Old and New Testaments. It's edited by an heir of one of the early dispensationalists. His name is John S. Feinberg. And he, again, that book displays the amazing differences that now exist within modern dispensationalism. Now let me show you this in chart form. There was a result. This onslaught of amillennialism had effects on dispensationalism. Dispensationalism began to feather out and break up into different forms. You'd always had around the hyper-dispensationalists. We have them in this city. Every time I write a press article on baptism, I no doubt will get a long paper from some hyper-dispensationalist telling me that baptism isn't for today. That's hyper-dispensationalism, Bullingeritism, all right? Or the Lord's only the Lord's Supper, and I'm not sure how they think about that. Anyway, then there still exists the old classic or Schofield dispensationalism. Out of that has come something called neo-dispensationalism, as you have the new Schofield Reference Bible and things like that. You have the progressive dispensationalism, which has moved even further away from dispensational premises. And then you have this odd thing that Mark Sarver talks about, the one people of God dispensationalist. I don't know how you could be that, because one of the sine qua non, one of the essentials of dispensationalism is that you have two peoples of God. So how are you going to have a one people of God dispensationalism? I don't know, but that's what they're saying. All right? So you had, as a result of the onslaught of amillennialism here upon dispensationalism, you have a splintering effect on dispensationalism. Now, a lot of this splintering effect has not yet begun to filter down to the local churches, but if you go to seminaries that are historically dispensational in character, you'll see it with a vengeance. All right? Now, just one more thing to say by way of conclusion to our whole study. There's a man by the name of James Orr, and he wrote a book that I have found tremendously helpful, and I think he wrote it in the early 1900s. It's called The Progress of Dogma. And what Orr does there is argue a thesis that's really very interesting. He argues that the history of the church displays doctrinal development in logical order. In other words, the history of the church is logical in terms of the doctrinal development. You see there, first you have the doctrine of the Word of God thrashed out in the 2nd and 3rd century, then the doctrine of God and the Trinity in the 4th century thrashed out, the doctrine of man, and in the doctrine of sin and grace in the 5th century, and then in the 16th century with Luther, after the long period of the Dark Ages, you have the doctrine of salvation clarified with his doctrine of justification by faith alone, and with the doctrine of the sovereignty of grace with Calvin. And then you move on to the doctrine of the church in the 17th century. It's a very interesting thesis. If you ever want to do some interesting reading and give yourself a little synopsis of church history and its doctrinal character, read James Orr's book, The Progress of Dogma. Now, I have to tell you that I think you see in eschatology something like this, that it seems like in the last couple of centuries, now the church has turned its attention to the whole subject of eschatology, and that we're seeing in our own time the thrashing out and the clarifying and the bringing to a more fine-tuned understanding of the whole doctrine of the what is called last things, or the doctrine of eschatology. At any rate, that's something that I think I can see as we see the rise of postmillennialism, antithesis, premillennial, the reaction of premillennialism, antithesis, and then the return of amillennialism in a kind of synthesis of those two positions. Now, many important lessons can be drawn from what we've been listening in on in terms of this long conversation in the church. One thing we learn from church history is to beware of reacting in an imbalanced way against the errors of the millenarian movement, lest we lose the lesson that its very arising teaches. We must not react. We must try to learn, see what things we may have our own deficiencies exposed. We must appreciate the light which God has been pleased to shine out of His Word in our own era. And we should attempt to give ourselves with renewed because of the helping power of God's Spirit to the study of the doctrine of last things. The last thing I want to say is, maybe you said, boy, this conversation has been complicated. I know. This is why I told you in the first lesson that you might subtitle our historical introduction to eschatology, Eschatology Made Difficult. The subtitle of the next section, when we come to the Bible, is Eschatology Made Simple. All right? Because God makes things simple where men make them very complicated. Again, if you want any of these overheads, you can get a copy or a copy of them in the church office. If you have questions in the time that we have remaining here, and I've got a little note that tells me to repeat your questions before I talk about them, so I'll try to remember to do that. Yes, John Hall? Well, those are two very different names. John Hall asked me to comment on where John MacArthur and Harold Camping fit. John MacArthur fits someplace in the neo-dispensationalist, progressive dispensationalist camp. Master's Seminary, he is self-proclaimed, John MacArthur is a self-proclaimed dispensationalist, but he has clearly moved away from some of the views of the classic dispensationalists. For instance, just as a for instance, John MacArthur does not believe the Sermon on the Mount is for the millennials. He believes it's for Christians today. Now, the idea that the Sermon on the Mount was for the millennium is the view of classic dispensationalism as found in Scofield Reference Bible. Okay. Harold Camping, I'm sad to say, Harold Camping is a really odd character because he's an amillennialist. I hate to say that. I don't even want to say it. But he's an amillennialist that's doing something that historically only millenarians have done, and that's just trying to calculate the date of Christ's return. Frankly, I warn you against Harold Camping because I think he's a dangerous man. I do. I think he has a lot of idiosyncrasies that I fear have been created just to draw away disciples after himself. One of them, this whole business of calculating the date of Christ's return, even doing it with a little question mark at the end, assumes that you can do it from the Bible, and the Bible teaches you can't do it. Anyway. So, there's my view from MacArthur and Harold Camping. Other questions? Comments? That's not fair! I haven't got to the Bible yet. I stand right where the Bible does. Yes, Joseph Ken. Yeah, let me repeat your question, see if I understand it. Joseph is asking whether something of the attraction of dispensationalism didn't consist in a reaction against modernism and the tendency of modernism to interpret the Bible very poetically and spiritualize it, not take things literally, and the church reacted against that because historically all these passages are taken literally. Well, let me respond first of all by saying historically that's not true. In the history of the church there was a tendency, in fact, in the early church, very pronounced in the early church, for a school of interpretation that was highly allegorical. In fact, the whole medieval church is characterized by the fourfold meaning of Scripture. And one of the fourfold meanings of Scripture is allegorizing it to find out what it teaches about philosophy or something else. So, also in the history of the church, there was a school of thought that was very literalistic. So, I don't think you can say that that historically the church was one place or the other. Probably wasn't any place as clearly as it should have been. But then, it is true, I think, that when passages like the book of Genesis, chapters 1 through 11, began to be interpreted in a very non-literal, poetic way in order to slip in evolution through the door and to make it consistent with Christianity, that there was a reaction. Of course, you see this in human events all the time. There's overreaction. And then people want to take everything literal. And they want to adopt the interpretive view that literal wherever possible. Well, I'm sorry, I don't think that's a biblical view. Literal wherever possible. Anything's possible with God. You could have a seven-headed dragon come up out of the sea. God could do that. We have literal wherever possible. Let's interpret the dragon with 10 heads and 7. What is it? 10? Can't remember. 10 and 7 anyway, something like that. Let's interpret that literally. God could have that happen. Obviously, nobody takes that literally, not even dispensationalists. So, let's not overreact into literal wherever possible. The proper interpretive principle in the Bible is that you interpret the literature of the Bible in the way it was intended to be interpreted, according to its literary genre. or its literary character. If it was poetry, you've got to interpret poetically. If it was just history, you've got to interpret it historically. If it's narrative, you've got to interpret it that way. If it's parable, you've got to interpret it that way. You interpret the Bible the way God intended it to be interpreted. And there are sufficient signs in any given part of the Bible to tell you what kind of literature it is and how it should be interpreted. Dennis?
Well, okay, that's a sensitive question. First of all, I want to be very clear that there's no conflict between being a member of this Reformed Baptist Church and being premillennial. Right? We don't make a person's millennial position a matter of doctrinal and church fellowship. I want to say that very clearly. Is there a conflict between being Reformed and being premillennial? However, there have been Reformed theologians that were premillennial, not a few of them. Okay? In my own view, this is clear. What I'm about to say is very clear. No Reformed confession that I'm aware of has ever explicitly stated premillennialism. Not taught in Reformed confession. It's not there. It's simply not mentioned. My own view is that the view is that's most consistent with our own confession. Chapters 31 and 32, my own view is that I have a very difficult time seeing how premillennialism can be squared with those chapters. But it isn't explicitly condemned either. And I think the most natural understanding of those chapters is in an amillennial or postmillennial direction. But, now, if you ask me if Reformed theology is consistent with dispensationalism, that's a different question. Reformed theology is not consistent with dispensationalism. Historic Christian theology is not consistent with dispensationalism, because historic Christian theology has always understood that the church is the new and true Israel of God. And historic premillennialism has understood that too. So, no, I don't think dispensationalism is consistent with Reformed theology. Okay, Larry Morrissey? All right, well, let's just... Larry is asking the question, is Acts chapter 1 and the apostles' question to Christ, were they on the right track, or were they totally deluded even to ask the question? Right? In other words, was there anything in prophecy that legitimately led them to expect that God would restore the kingdom to Israel? The passage is Acts chapter 1, verse 6, actually, it's the key verse. And so when they had come together, they were asking him, saying, Lord, is it at this time you are restoring the kingdom to Israel? He said to them, it is not for you to know times or epochs which the Father has fixed by his own authority. And Larry's question is Christ rebuking them and saying there's no such thing going to happen, it's not your business anyway, or is he halfway implying that God is going to restore the kingdom to Israel? Now, I'm only going to give you a partial response, but I am going to say that in Matthew 19, Jesus promises the 12 apostles they'll sit on 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And in Acts chapter 3, Peter, after the day of Pentecost, that's important to some people, says in verses 19 to 21, repent therefore and return, that your sins may be wiped away, in order that times of refreshing may come from the presence of the Lord, and that he may send Jesus the Christ appointed for you, whom heaven must receive until the period of the restoration of all things, about which God spoke by the mouth of his holy prophets from ancient times. Now, both the passages in Matthew 19 and Acts 3 lead me to think that However they understood the words restoring the kingdom to Israel, there is something, there is the prophecy that the kingdom will be restored to Israel, and that they were on the right track. How they exactly understood that, and what they understood by Israel, and all of those things, I'm not sure. But I do believe that the Bible predicts the restoration of the theocratic kingdom. But what that means is another question. And time is up. Dennis O'Connor, would you close us in prayer, please?